Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Did you know that the bold, smooth taste of Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed in your Keurig coffee maker and enjoyed at home? Dunkin's cold K-Cup pods were crafted to be brewed hot and enjoyed cold. And of course, they're packed with the Dunkin' flavor you crave. Brew over ice and sip in seconds. Because the home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Three Questions. I'm Andy Richter, and as you know, my whole life is late-night television. I don't care about anything but late-night television. So that's why I insisted that I get my next guest on this show. That's right. It's Jimbly Kimble.
No, you've pronounced that incorrectly, Andy. It's not Jimbly Kimble. It's Jimmy Kimmel.
Oh, Jimmy Kimmel. I'm sorry. I just was... Wendy the Slow Adult is my publicist.
That's Jim. Yeah, that's my Jimble Kimble.
Jimble Kimble, that's what she says.
reference to the Howard Stern show.
Yes, of which we are both devotees. You much more than me. You're like now a member of the family on the Stern show.
I feel like you could be a member of the family if you invested more time in the family.
That's true. That's true. And if I traveled more, you are all out there and then, you know, or you're out here too. And I'm more hunkered down in my little Burbank bunker. So.
Yeah, well, I go to New York usually once or twice a year. I haven't obviously in a while, but I always make a point to go on the show. I really love it. It's one of the few things I really enjoy doing.
It is. It's, and I mean, I'm listening to it. It just like I get annoyed when they replay things during the day. When I get back in the car and I turn it on, it's like, oh shit, I already heard this. God damn it.
If you learn how to use the app, which I've not, it's easy to fix that, but it's much easier to just, you know, there's some things that are just like, you just want to turn the radio on in the car and have it come to you.
Right, exactly. I'm like an app schmap. I don't have time for that. And also, too, I never think to turn anything on until I'm actually on the road. So if I'm fussing with the app, which, you know.
I was listening to you and Zach Galifianakis on your podcast, and you know, once I get something going, I don't want to change anything for fear that it might not work. So I was listening to it just on my phone, not with headphones, just listening to it as using the phone as a speaker. And then I realized I had to to go into my office and stuff. So I just held it with me. And sometimes I'll just put it right in my front pocket. And I had the speaker pointing out at my head. And that's like my version of a boom box, I guess.
Right. Or like a transistor radio that like a slow person would listen to the ball game on, you know.
I miss listening to the ball game on a radio. Being at a Dodgers game or something and somebody remembered to bring their radio, which I never did. And I was always jealous because you always, you know, you kind of half know what's going on when, even if you know a lot about baseball, if you're not paying really close attention to what's happening on the field, it's easy to get confused, especially when there's like a close play and you're like, so what happened? Wait, what? You don't know what's going on?
Yeah.
But I will tell you, when I was a disc jockey, I worked at a radio station in Palm Springs, KCMJ FM, and there was KCMJ AM. It was right when I say across the hall, I mean like your bathroom would be close to your kitchen. And no, it was automated. They'd run the Dodgers games. And so when I was there on the weekends doing my weekend shift, I would go in there and to entertain myself, I would put sound effects into the Dodgers game. So while the Dodgers broadcast was coming out of LA, I would like Vin Scully was like, and here's the pitch. And then you'd hear boing. And then people would call the radio station and I'd answer the phone and they'd say, I'm hearing strange sounds on the radio during the game. And I say, I know I'm hearing the same thing. It's coming out of LA. We don't know what's going on.
That's awesome. When I, that just reminds me of, when I lived in Chicago, and this is also a tangentially a radio story. There was a DJ there that was a personality jock. I mean, to call them shock jocks just seems like, it's like, no, they're not that shocking.
Who was it?
Jonathan Brandmeier.
Oh, he's one of my idols.
Oh, really? He was huge, huge. And he had a deal to do a TV show, to do like sort of like a comedy sketch talk show, like a late night talk show. And it was like Fred Silverman. And it was sort of like, it had something to do with like the fallout from the Arsenio Joan Rivers thing, or maybe before Arsenio. I don't remember exactly. But it was a syndicated show. Fred Silverman produced it, and they tried to make him into a TV host, and it didn't work.
I have it on VHS, by the way. I have that in my office right now on VHS.
Oh my God. Cause there was a group of us that were in an improv group, and they had two slots for researchers. Cause you couldn't be a writer, because then they'd have to pay you guild dues. Or you'd have to pay a guild rate. So you had to be, we were researchers. And the group of us, like, I was all for like, look, let's just go for it. Let's just each of us try and get that spot. Cause there was like six of us. Like, let's just each go for the two spots. And there were other guys in the group who are like, no, why don't we rotate in and out? And I was like, because I would like to get a real salary rather than one third of a salary or one sixth of a salary or whatever. And I was quickly shot down to the point where because I kept pushing the point, and it was kind of like, all right, they kind of like were like, hey, shut up. We're going to do this all as a group. Okay. So we like each of us worked 2 days a week, but we worked at the PBS station, WTTW in Chicago in their studios. And there was a current event show that was on five nights a week. John Calloway, I think was his name. But in his set was a bookshelf, like behind him and then behind the guest, it was a bookshelf. And I took some pieces of ham and put them between the books that so that they were hanging out. And for like a week, you could see when you turned on his show, pieces of ham hanging out of the books behind him. And it, like I say, it took a week. Like, it just shows how much, like, the quality control and what a sharp eye everybody had on that show.
Well, I do want to say, in Johnny B's defense, he was not a shock jock. He was just kind of a fun guy. He wasn't a shock jock. He was hugely popular in Phoenix before he went to Chicago. The impact that he left on every disc jockey, I went to college in Phoenix, on every disc jockey that I worked with was enormous. He was so popular. He had like a 30 share or something in Phoenix.
Yeah, yeah.
He had a band and they would play and he'd do like funny songs. Yeah. But he was really great and a really funny guy. And yeah, the TV show didn't work. He had almost too much energy for television. And radio guys have a hard time on television. And I think there's a weird reason why, a very practical reason why, which is they're used to being like an inch and a half from a microphone. And when you're not close to that microphone, you feel you have to shout.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and just amp up the energy.
And it's hard to get over not being able to control the volume of your voice, and you're not wearing headphones, and it just kind of changes everything. And I think that's like, if somebody sat down with all these radio guys beforehand and said, hey, listen, you're going to be shouting. It's going to be much too much, especially for late night television. You just need to focus and calm down. I probably wouldn't have a job, I guess.
All right. Well, this podcast is kind of, you know, as one of my guest ones called it, origin story, because everything's got to be freaking comic books now. So this is kind of like, you know, this is your life. You're going to, you know, share with us where you come from. And you're originally East Coast, right? Brooklyn?
I'm from Mill Basin, which is down in the bottom of Brooklyn. It's not the cool area. It's not the place where all the hipsters live now. It's pretty much the same as when I lived there.
Really?
It's an Italian and Jewish neighborhood in the bottom of, it's for people from Brooklyn who never go to the city, yeah, who stay in Brooklyn all the time.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There are in Chicago, there was the same thing. My barber told me he hadn't been downtown for 25 years. And that was, that was when he got his barber's license. Like, so there's just people that live in the city are like, I'm not going down there. So And is it, do you still have people there, or do you still have relatives that live there? Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah, sure. We moved to Las Vegas when I was 9 years old. My Uncle Frank was a cop in New York. He retired. He was 40 years old, I think. He decided, he heard that you could get a job as a security guard at a casino in Las Vegas pretty easily if you'd been a police officer.
Yeah.
And so they went out there. They actually, this is a true story. It sounds like it's not true, but it's absolutely true. They were going to move to Florida. They went down to Florida and they put a down payment of $100 on a house, which was a lot of money. And they were staying with friends. And in the morning, my Aunt Chippy saw an alligator in the pool in the backyard at this friend's house. And she said, I didn't give birth to three daughters to have them eaten by an alligator. And so Florida was out. They forfeited the $100 and decided to move to Las Vegas.
Wow.
And that they did, and we followed them about a year and a half later.
And all three of their children were bitten by rattlesnakes. And so it was just because they led the way. I mean, did your dad have a job lined up?
My dad did not have a job lined up.
And
fact, a local lounge singer helped him get a job. He was working at IBM in New York, and he got a job working for this company called Summa Corporation, which is a company Howard Hughes owned and founded. They owned 7 casino hotels in Las Vegas, and they had, their office wasn't even an office building. It was like this ranch on right near where that Welcome to Las Vegas sign. It was right near that.
Yeah.
And they worked on this ranch, and it was like in a house, basically. And they were operating the computer systems that determined the odds on the slot machines in the casinos.
Oh, wow. Wow. So your dad, could he finagle the slots to, you know?
You know what? It's interesting. Like, and people don't know this if you don't live in Las Vegas, but there are certain percentages, payout percentages. So if you're on the strip, you probably have the lowest chance of winning money on a slot machine if you're in a big casino on the strip. Then you get into downtown and the odds are higher when they have to, and then you get to like a supermarket. And that's where the odds are best.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like at the, what about the airport?
The airport is the worst.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's like the same reason a pack of gum is $3 at the airport. It's the same principle. That I learned from him. And that's what he did in Las Vegas. And until we moved to Arizona in the later 80s.
And how old were you when you moved to Vegas?
I was 9.
And how old when you moved to Arizona?
18.
Okay. So that was pretty much your formative years into young manhood were in Las Vegas.
Yes, for sure.
Is that a weird, I can't even conceive of growing up in Las Vegas because it just doesn't seem to have its own identity that is in any way genuine. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I could see why people think that. And I didn't, it was never obvious to me until I moved from Las Vegas and people couldn't believe I was from Las Vegas. But it's a place where we went to church and played Little League and, had the same upbringing that anybody has. The only difference being that most of our parents worked on the strip. You know, I'm like my best friend Cleto, who's now my band leader. His dad, who's also in my band, was a room service waiter at Caesar's Palace for many years. And he'd be requested by Sammy Davis Jr. and Bill Cosby and these guys when they would come into town. So it was like a regular job that was interesting. And this weird dose of celebrity injected into everything because I lived 2.5 miles from the strip. It's where I grew up. And yet, it wasn't like we didn't hang out there. We didn't have showgirls living next door or anything like that. But when we wanted it, we could get right to it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it does seem like it would be, well, it's like sort of like any Western city, but with like a little bit of glamour and a little bit of crime, too. Like,
a little bit of crime, a little bit of desperation, maybe more desperation than any place. And you could see it. I mean, more pawn shops than you'll see in the typical town.
Yeah.
More motels, more hookers,
Yeah. Yeah. All the times that I went to Las Vegas, there's this, and I don't know whether it's just my emotional makeup, but it's like there's a palpable sort of sense of desperation. You know what I mean? Like just like people losing money. And do you feel that while you're there? Do you feel that like, oh, like I'm going to school and everything, but just, a few blocks away, there are people losing their children's college funds.
No, you know, when you're a kid, I know, that's not something I was really aware of until I became an adult. But yeah, I think that like this, you know, like suicide rate is right up there with the Pacific Northwest. And up there, I think it's largely weather has a lot to do with it, the gloominess of living up there. And in Vegas, people just kind of, there are a lot of people who come for their last shot and they're like, you know, I'm at the end here and maybe a miracle will happen. And if it doesn't, goodbye.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, is it true that you and all your friends had to wear pinky rings?
We didn't have to. I will say my Uncle Vinny does wear a pinky ring.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's got hands like an ape.
I one time bought a ring that I intended, like, it's like a cool antique kind of like old buckle ring that I was going to wear as a pinky ring. And I put it on and I was just like, no fucking way. No way. I cannot do this. You know,
you made that decision on your own.
Yeah. I just put it on. It's like when I bought a leather jacket, like a cool, not like a Fonzie biker jacket, but more like a, you know, like a motocross leather jacket.
Yeah.
You know, at Berman's, the leather experts, when I was 15 or something. And I bought it and I got it home. And there was something about the store mirror wasn't as truthful as a home mirror. And I put it on when I was home and I was just like, I look ridiculous.
I have that experience with every hat I ever buy. Yeah. You know, you go on vacation and you buy a fedora. You know?
Yeah, yeah,
this
yeah.
This could be my thing, you know? Yeah. My grandfather wore a hat. Maybe this would be my thing. You realize. You know what? I think, you know why we do that on vacation? Because our friends aren't with us. And then when you have to face the prospect of walking into the office and all your friends being there and seeing you in this hat now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know you're going to get mocked.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, I'm going to be a hat guy now.
Surrounded by strangers is the reason they sell so many hats on vacation.
Yeah, hat guys, I'm sure that hat guys at some point will rise up and like demand representation or not, because there's so many hat guys that I just, like hat guys, I judge hat guys. Almost all hat guys, unless they're like a wizened old Westerner, you know, yeah. I just, like just a guy at a yard party in shorts and a shirt and then like with like a little like pork pie hat. I just am like, what are you doing?
I feel that way too, only when it comes to white people.
Yeah. Oh,
white people are not allowed to wear funny hats. But Steve Harvey, like you see Steve Harvey, you're like, yeah, he looks good. And Cedric the Entertainer, you're like, yep,
yeah, that I guess works. Yeah, that is true.
100%. Sam Jackson wears a Kangol hat all the time.
Yep. Yeah,
George,
you're right.
Lopez has like one of those hats on all the time, and you never think he looks dumb.
Yeah, because I'm thinking like Jimmy Vivino, our old band leader, he wears hats like crazy, and it's like, well, yeah, but it works on him, you know?
Yeah,
like,
kind of.
Yeah. I'm probably glad.
Maybe
to
you
tell
just
him.
Got used to it.
what predicated the move to Arizona?
My dad lost his job and was out of work for a year and then got a job in Arizona. I'd gone to college at UNLV for a year in Vegas. And then there was some deal where if you were hired, you'd get in-state tuition for your children. And so my father said, we're moving to Arizona. And I was like, well, I'll miss you guys. It was really nice knowing you. I'm in college, you know.
It's
normal for people to be away from their families in college. And they said, no, you're coming. I said, well, no, I'm not coming. I'm going to stay here and go to college. And then I found out how much rent was. And I think I was making like $4.15 an hour at the Miller's Outpost at the time.
Yeah.
And I realized that there was no way I could support myself. So I moved with them.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's gotta be a good feeling. Were you living at, oh, and you were living at home through that first year of college, right?
Yeah. I mean, my family, we didn't think about college until after I'd graduated high school. There was never a discussion of college.
Really?
Yeah, it was like the 13th grade. It was like August came and we were like, well, I guess you should go to UNLV next year. And I did.
Yeah, it's right there. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. You know, I think back and I can't believe it, especially now I see like my father, how involved he is with my niece and nephew and figuring out their college and, you know, the SAT tests and getting them a tutor and all this stuff. It's like, where were you when I was a teenager?
Yeah, I know. I remember when my son's in college now and when he was going through the process and people, other parents talking about it and like, my kid's applying to 7 colleges, my kid's applying to 8. And like my son asked me like, how many did you apply to? And I said, 1. The one that I went to? Like,
I'm not sure I even applied. I just signed up.
Yeah, just show up and do it. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, it's a different ballgame. It's the same thing with, but like my parents, they go to like the parent-teacher conference. That was it. Yeah. You know, sport, you know, same if you were in a sport, they'd go to, they watch the game. But beyond that, like you're on your own. And that's, you know, that was always a difference of opinion between my ex-wife and I was always like, we'd go, you know, we would go to the parent nights or the orientation nights and they'd tell us about the math they're teaching. And she would realize that I just was zoning out or trying to look at my phone, you know, and I would tell her, I was like, yeah, but it's between them. It's between the kid and the teacher.
I feel the same way.
What's it got to do with me?
I can't tell you how many times I've said, I've graduated kindergarten already.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, it's like, that's your business. I don't need to know. And also, I can't absorb it anyway, even if I try to focus. I mean, I was shitty at math then. I'm shitty at math now. But I'm also a very self-involved guy. A showbiz asshole.
Well, you know, that's the way it was when, you know, our parents, yeah, they'd come, like, if we have, like, a, like, the band, if I was playing my clarinet in a band recital, they'd be there for sure.
Yeah.
You know, if there was a game or something, they'd come to it, but unless I was in trouble, nothing happened as far as school goes, you know?
I don't know. My kids are pretty good at school. My daughter, especially, my daughter's like, you know, had a lot of attention issues early on, you know, was basically a wild animal until age 9. But now she's like straight A's and super organized and like, And that has nothing to do with me. I mean, and in so many ways, and I'm sure you've noticed this, your children are who they are, like fresh out of the, fresh out of the womb. They're just like, you can kind of sense like, oh, this is what this kid is like. And then they just sort of spend a lifetime being, it being reaffirmed to you.
You create, you conjure up this personality for them. Like our son, Billy, you know, he had, as you know, operations right when he was born and he was, you know, this sympathetic character in our lives, like, oh, you know, poor Billy and oh, this baby, is he gonna live? What's going to happen? Really like became very much the center of our lives in a much greater way than a baby usually becomes the center of your life. And now he's just a maniac. He's a pain in the ass. He's a crazy little monster who runs around scaring us and roaring at people and biting and stuff. And
what is he, 5? Is he four, like 5
he just
now?
Turned 4.
Just turned 4. Like,
hey, well, do you know how worried we were about you?
Yeah.
Why are you biting me?
Yeah, I was on TV yelling at the president about you.
I was myself on television because of you.
You know how much money I've been given to that place? Because of you?
Emmy award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Did you know that the bold, smooth taste of Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed in your Keurig coffee maker and enjoyed at home? Dunkin's cold K-Cup pods were crafted to be brewed hot and enjoyed cold. And of course, they're packed with the Dunkin' flavor you crave. Brew over ice and sip in seconds. Because the home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
My sister has a five-year-old, and my assistant has a toddler now. And I just when I see him, I'm just reminded of this period that I called high stakes boredom, which is just like watching a kid like do the same thing 50 times, but you can't take your eye off them because they might fall and split their skull open on like, you know, a twig or something, you know, or poke their own eye out with just for fun, yes. I guess.
Yeah.
And you signed up for it again.
I did.
You were out from under it from had two grown
I was in
kids.
The clear.
Yeah.
I was on a magic carpet ride to Europe.
Yeah. And you're like, I can't wait to change my parents' diapers. I want to change a diaper now.
My oldest daughter turns 30 this summer. You know, it's I could be a grandfather soon.
Yeah, yeah. That's a spread. Wow. Does it keep you young, though? I kind of feel like the longer the babies are around, it keeps you from slipping into being old and crotchety.
It keeps you young and makes you old, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can get that.
It's a lot of responsibility. You know, when sometimes I feel like my wife doesn't understand that I did this once already. Like, yeah. She'd be like sometimes it's like, if I'm not holding up my end of the bargain, I'll sometimes go like, oh my God, do you know how many times I woke up in the middle of the night before I even met you?
Well, now is that, it's just like, it's the burden of it. It's like, I don't want to do that. Or is it just kind of the, like, does she sweat things more than you do just because you've been through it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, for sure. Yeah. I think that's natural. I think there's when you have adult children, I'm sure as you realize your kids are, right there.
Yeah.
You realize like, oh, okay. All that stuff I was worried about, I maybe was worrying a little bit too much about that kind of stuff. And so you have that wisdom to comfort you. And then, you know, like for instance, my son is 4 years old and he's got this best friend named Trey. He loves his kid, you know, and Trey's moving. And my wife's very upset about it. She's like, he's going to miss Trey so much. And I just go, you know what? He's not even going to think about Trey. I'm going to tell you right now that he doesn't understand what moving means. Mm-hmm. He is like a dog where you leave the house in the morning and he's panting. And then you come back at night and he's jumping on you. I mean, it's like their kids are more like dogs than I think we like to admit.
Not just dogs, but just like little animals. Like they are, they live in the moment. There's like, they're, you know, I mean, depending on the kid, they're like, you know, scared of being eaten.
You know,
like,
what's great evidence that kids live in the moment. They will tell you the same joke 40 times in a row.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
They don't understand that there are diminishing returns on the joke. Yeah, it doesn't matter to them because each time they're telling you the joke for the first time. Right. Each time you like throw them in the air, they then want to be thrown in the air again and thrown in the air again. And the fact that you're now tired of throwing them in the air doesn't mean anything to them. They want you to keep going because they exist in that moment and only that moment. And there's no thinking about the future at all. And I guess it's why teenagers think they're indestructible. I guess it's why it's like some people won't even get the vaccine. They have like a kind of an immaturity or something. Where
Like they're an immortality that's based on ignorance.
Yeah, ignorance of reality. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Although I do love picturing you screaming at a four-year-old, there's a thing called diminishing returns.
Write this on the refrigerator with those little letter magnets we have.
Now, nobody in your show and your family's in show business. So what happened? You were...
Well, some of them are now, but...
Well, yeah, because you gave them jobs. Jesus Christ.
I was the first one. It was an accident, I think, probably. I was planning to be an artist. That was always my plan for my life. I started watching David Letterman. I loved him. I started listening to Howard Stern, tapes of Howard Stern. My uncle would send me, and I loved him. And I got it in my head that it might be fun to be on the radio. And it just so happened this guy I worked with at this clothing store was on the local college radio station. And he said, "You'd be funny on the radio. I can get you on. And I said, "All right, I'd love to do that." And I started doing that. And then I just loved it so much. I loved being in radio stations so much. I decided to make that my career. And then it just so happened that I was doing morning radio in LA at K-Rock with these guys, Kevin and Bean. And television producers would call and ask me to audition for things. So that's how I got into television. There was never a plan to get into television.
Oh, wow. And was this all in Arizona when you started doing radio?
I started in Las Vegas in high school.
In Las Vegas. Oh, okay. So do you think that if they hadn't called you, that you'd be still doing radio?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, probably. I mean, hopefully. Yeah. It's a hard business. It's especially hard now.
Oh, it's awful now.
It's really awful. Terrible. Well, now it's evolved into podcasting. And I think it's in some ways it's better if you can get an audience. It's great because you don't really have a boss, which is a miracle. And you could practice, which you couldn't do when I was a kid trying to get into radio. You just hang around the radio station until somebody let you on. And then you'd be on maybe once a week on the weekends, and you're talking in between records. So you're really not getting a lot of practice. But now the idea that anyone with a computer can do a show, that's a huge, just doing it is like 80% of it.
Yeah. Now, do you feel good about that? Or is there a part of that that annoys you?
There is a part of it that annoys me. And I know when we listen to Howard, you hear it's annoying, but I do feel more good about it than annoyed. I wish I didn't have to jump through those hoops. And I wish I didn't have to like volunteer for 3 years before I finally got paid nothing to be on the radio. Now it all worked out, obviously, but I do think that my skills would have improved more quickly if I'd been able to, I guess I could have just talked into a tape recorder, you know?
Yeah.
But it's just, you have to have like some kind of a reward, and even you just want a few people listening.
Well, now when you know, as this evolved from going, you know, from doing the radio, auditioning for things. And there was the first TV thing was Win Ben Stein's Money.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then when you get to the point where it's like, how about doing a talk show that's just you? Do you have qualms about it? Are you like, kind of like, I'm not sure I want to do this?
You know, nobody ever asked me that question when I wasn't even offered the job so much as it was explained to me that I would be getting this job. And I know that sounds ridiculous.
And I'm sure that there are people who are like, oh, fuck you know, but I believe you.
You know, when I was a kid, like I had a cake for my 16th birthday that said Late Night with David Letterman, the cake on it. So you would think, at my license plate said L.A. Night on it. You would think that I set out to become a late night talk show host.
Yeah,
and that's
not
at all what it was. I just loved that television show. And it was like, you know, I was just me trying to make conversation with people about the show because there weren't that many people who watched it at the time. So I enjoyed wearing a Late Night with David Letterman t-shirt because sometimes people would come up to me and say, oh, hey, you watched that show? And then we would have a conversation about Larry Bud Melman.
Right.
The truth of the matter is that I never set out to do that. And everything is just as you described it. One thing led to another. One thing led to another. It wasn't like I had this plan of how I was going to build my career. And I do see people because, you know, I have people on my show every night who, you know, sometimes had this plan from childhood, you know, and their parents were in on it and their parents quit their job and moved to LA. And you go like, what?
Yeah.
My dad actually tried to pay me $200 a week to stay in Arizona and not go do my first morning show in Seattle. Like this is all I wanted was to do a morning radio show. I got that opportunity in a big market, in the perfect size market for me to hopefully succeed. And my dad tried to thwart it with a small amount of money.
Let's see, what price can my son be bought for? Oh, how about $200?
It seemed like a lot at the time. I know it was a lot for him. I also knew in the back of my mind that he would stop paying it about 5 weeks in. So, you know, and then it would be too late. So what was I going to do?
But yeah, right.
It was not my intention. I went into a meeting with the president of ABC. He, at the time, was looking for a late night host, and I didn't know it. We had a very nice conversation almost the whole time we talked about David Letterman. At the end of the meeting, I went home. I called my agent. I said, yeah, we had a great meeting. It was very nice. My agent didn't know what was going on. In fact, he's also Jon Stewart's agent, and he thought Jon Stewart was going to get that job. And then Adam Carolla's wife, Lynette, was this president of ABC's receptionist. And she called my ex-wife and said, ABC, they're going to give Jimmy the midnight talk show at the time. And my ex-wife's like, hey, they said they're going to give you this show. And I was like, what? What show? And the next thing I knew, by like the next day, I was in their office and someone opened a bottle of champagne and said, welcome to the ABC family.
Wow. Do you think that sort of this, you know, backward stumble into it made it possible? Do you think that if you had been just knowing yourself, knowing the way you're built, if you had been focused on it and, you know, and that license plate had actually been like a mission statement or something, do you think it would have worked out like this? Or do you think that there's just...
I really don't know, because I would like to be able to say no, it worked better this way, but I really was focused on doing morning radio at a great radio station. I was very, very focused on that, and that did happen. So I know I've had at least one instance of setting my mind to something and it working out. And now it certainly wasn't a direct path, and it definitely wasn't a pleasant path. It was a very rough path to working at K-Rock in LA, in which I was had to move around the country a lot and was fired a lot of times and really went through, it really was an unhappy time in my life in a lot of ways. But, when you look back at this stuff, I'm sure you do this. And I know the way when you guys started your show and you get these, you know, multi-week long contracts.
At one point it was week to week.
Insanely. Yeah. It's just so insulting and so unnecessary and just bad from beginning to end. You know, it's like, if you're an executive putting your talent in that situation, like, what do you think they're going to do if it does work out? They're going to hold against you. Like, you should be prepared for success, you know? And, you know, anyway, but,
The lack of people skills at people at the upper echelons of entertainment power is jaw-dropping at times. It's just jaw-dropping.
The same people will treat you like absolute shit at the beginning. Yep. I mean, like bring you into a meeting, tell you they're going to do something, get you all excited, and then never talk to you again.
Mm-hmm.
And then the way they treat you to the point where it's really kind of terrible, where if there's a problem, they won't even tell you. They will just lie to you. They will just say, no, it's great. This is great and great and great and great. And then you find out like, oh, wait, what? This idea of talent relations where they treat you like you're some kind of show horse, but then you inevitably will find out the truth. Inevitably the bad news comes and, it doesn't make it any better. It's just like this really short-term thinking, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's hard to figure. It's hard to figure out how any of it works. Even just like the process of okay, you and I made a game show together, right?
Yeah.
I thought you did a great job. I thought it was a fun show. And, you know, the ratings were pretty good on it. You know, it was not an easy show to do. It was kind of hard to put together. That show has never been canceled. As far as you and I know, that show is just in between seasons because no one ever said anything about it.
And what was that, like 5 years
ago? Yeah, it was on. Yeah. And then we just kind of waited to see, you know, if they were going to pick it up again. And no one ever said they weren't. and no one ever said they were.
Yeah.
And that was just it.
The thing that, I mean, what I always feel it is that no one, they cannot stick their neck out for any, they want you in. They sense like, and usually it's like they want you because someone else has spent money on you. Like, well, all these, there's a precedent of people spending money on this guy and him not flaming out. So, all right, come on over here and we'll spend some money on you. But they can't really like back you 100% because if you fail, they're afraid that they'll be caught up in the vacuum of your failure, like a tumbleweed sucked in behind you. Yeah. So it's like, I never liked that fucker. You signed him, right? Yeah, but I mean, I always had qualms, you know?
Yeah.
Which is just like such bad parenting. You know, like, I love you, but you better, if you don't do well, I won't love you anymore. I'll have to not love you. That's how it goes.
A lot of the way show business, television specifically, I don't know anything about the movie business, but a lot of the way television works is, Am I going to be embarrassed by the result of this? So yes. Am I going to be embarrassed if I don't pick this show up? If the answer is yes, then I'm going to pick the show up. If I order a pilot and then bury it and no one ever gets it, no one else ever sees it, then I'm pretty safe. If a lot of people are bidding on it, I'm going to bid on it just because a lot of people are bidding on it. And if I wind up wasting money and being wrong, I can always go, well, we were all wrong. You know, look at that.
Mm-hmm.
That's how so much of it goes.
Yeah, it's all covering your ass. It's all covering your ass. And then also, too, like the thing that I think is, and I've always said this, you could go into any network, any studio, and just randomly fire every third person, and it wouldn't hurt a thing. It wouldn't matter at all. There's just so many people, and especially in television, you go in and you pitch a show, and you're pitching to, like, 8 people, and now they're all fucking younger than me, you know, and it's all, and they all, everybody's got to have an opinion where it's like, well, maybe the opinion is, well, that guy has a track record and, you know, it's been pretty good. And why don't we just say, okay, you know, but they all need to have an opinion and they all wait for the person with the most power to express the opinion.
I'm okay with them all having an opinion. It's just when they're trying to guess what the opinion of the person were. And the guessing is what really kills you. That's where you're like, oh, my God.
I know.
And there also is, by the way, it's funny us harping about this as we've both been pretty successful and we're still angry. No. There seems to be, and this I don't think exists in any other industry, there's a middle part when it comes to like television and television production. There's this group of people between the people on the top and the people who actually make the shows, whose only job seems to be having meetings with people who might one day be on their network, but that's not really what the meeting is about. The meeting is just there to make the managers and agents look like they have some kind of a power. Mm-hmm. So like, I mean, I just remember being a disc jockey and my manager would send me on all these network meetings and I would have these meetings with people who've gone on to become like heads of networks, you know, very, you know, successful people. And I had a meeting with this guy, Bob Greenblatt. He ran NBC. You know who that guy is?
I remember.
He had a partner named David Janilari. And they're very nice guys. And I had a great meeting with these guys. And it wasn't about anything in particular. But I remember coming out of this meeting and thinking like, well, these seem like great guys. And they definitely love me. And then sure enough, you know, it's like, oh, we absolutely love him. We loved him. He was absolutely great. And I never heard from these people again. Like they're probably producing dozens of television shows in between meeting me and whatever. It's like, wait, what happened? It went well, right? I mean, like everybody agrees that it was great. There's no reason to say otherwise.
Yeah.
Why did we have that meeting? Like what could have been better than what
happened? Had to do something that day. Had to fill up the schedule.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Did you know that the bold, smooth taste of Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed in your Keurig coffee maker and enjoyed at home? Dunkin's cold K-Cup pods were crafted to be brewed hot and enjoyed cold. And of course, they're packed with the Dunkin' flavor you crave. Brew over ice and sip in seconds. because the home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
You know, late night has changed. You know, I mean, now, the thing that's amazing to me about late night is the numbers, is the difference in the ratings.
And yeah,
just
right.
Like what, yeah, like what is a successful number now is just, you know, it just feels like nobody's watching anymore.
Yeah, it's not really true because what really is happening, and you know this, is that people are just watching on YouTube.
Yeah,
watching. They're just not watching through their television set.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you really look at, you know, YouTube does a good job, probably a better job than Nielsen does of actually tallying what the numbers are as far as people really watching something. There are more people watching late night television than there were when Johnny Carson was doing it. People have this idea that, like, oh, well, you know, things have diminished. They haven't. They're just not watching it on TV. YouTube has done this brilliant job of getting us to produce television shows for them for free.
Yes. Yes. Now, does that matter to the people that are above you? Like, do they look at it and go like, oh, you're still doing a good job? Like, because it doesn't affect the ad rates. You know, like, does it affect the kind of bottom line of the show?
Weirdly, it hasn't. I think there will come a time when it does. I think there's still people, sponsors are willing to pay a premium for quality content, you know, and I don't mean to say that the things people put on YouTube aren't, but, you know, these are what we put on the air on our shows are network approved. You're not going to find out that, that there was a Klansman in the sketch.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's safe for them to advertise on. I think over time, yeah, that will become maybe an issue. But, you know, like the days of talk show hosts making gigantic amounts of money are over. You know, that's not going to happen in the next incarnation. But there will also be 40 talk shows, or there probably are already, but there will also be 200 talk shows, which I think is probably better. You know, you'd be able to be more niche oriented, you'll be able to have a smaller audience, still make a living and do the show that you really want to do.
Mm-hmm. Are you still happy doing it? Are you still like, do you still enjoy it?
Yeah. I mean, the grind is a grind and there's no two ways about it. And I also know from previous experience in my life that whatever I have to do, I don't want to do. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. Things that I'm looking forward to, when I see them on the calendar, I go, oh, shit. You know, and that's just me. And it's just my personality. And I wish I could figure that out. But ultimately, I've had the luxury of choosing who I work with, which is, you know, that's the best part of it. And you get to work with people that you like. And people that are competent, and you don't have to explain the same things over and over and over again. And it is fun. You know, I mean, there are many nights where I'll walk down the stairs to the stage and go, okay, I got some good jokes here. This will be fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's always fun to do the show itself.
But I mean, how much longer do you think you're going to want to do?
I'm not going to do it forever. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's, you know, I'm not going to get removed from television. That's for sure.
Oh, I just want to see you sitting in the chair as they wheel you away in the wheeled chair, but from behind the desk.
Yeah. I think that I've been doing it a long time and not that much longer.
Yeah. One aspect, and I referenced it earlier, you have like 8,000 relatives working with you.
Yes.
And for you.
Yes.
That's unique. I mean, at least in television.
I love my family more than others do, I guess.
It's not unique for like a construction company or, you know, or a bakery, But in television, it's...
When you're Italian, there's no difference.
What is this? I mean, what is this about? What do you think it is about you that, you know, is there a comfort you get from it? Is it a trust level, or is it some obligation that you got to bring the whole clan along?
There are some elements of all of that.
Yeah.
There's also guilt, right? That's part of it too. You know, you have like certain amount of like, why do I make so much money and, you know, this person in my family doesn't, you know, that's always...
Yeah, yeah.
But ultimately, more than anything, I think that something that I believe is that if I think someone is funny, then others will also. So there are certain people that I've identified like over the course of my career and like helped them or, you know, given them a position on my show or help them get their own show. And it seems to always work out. I mean, even just like in the case of Guillermo, you know, his security guard, like, you know, this guy's in the parking lot. Like, this guy's funny, you know, like,
yeah,
I think he's funny.
He has charisma. Yeah.
He has charisma and people do sometimes get the idea that he's just like this caricature or something like that, whatever, but this is a genuinely funny person. Like this is a, you know, like off camera, even more so, like a funny ball breaking kind of guy. Yeah. And I just always figure like, well, if I think they're funny, probably other people will think they're funny. And it just turned out to be true. And I also come from a funny family. I heard you and Zach talking about your like funny families. And I, you know, I'm not the funniest person in my family, you know, so I, like, to me, the funniest person I know is probably my cousin Sal. He is like just funny on a
level. As a laugh getter. Yeah.
His jokes are beyond inside jokes. Sometimes his jokes will come like from 35 years in your past and they're at the tip of his tongue and you can't believe it. And it's not just like with his relatives, like, you know, it's hard to explain, but Sal's the kind of guy you can meet the first 8 times you meet him, you're like, yeah, he seems like a nice guy. He's pretty funny. And then the 9th time you go, oh, okay, now I get it. Because he's now memorized every character in your whole life. And he knows every reference that will hit you in a certain spot. And so I always felt like, you know, why not give it a try? Plus, it was a way to make my show different. You know, it's hard to make the show different. And these talk shows are all basically the same. Mm-hmm. You know, there's monologue and the desk and a band and all that stuff. And so for me, like, I was like, well, how am I going to make it different? And bringing my family into the mix was one way to make it different. And, you know, so that's been done to a certain extent. Like Dave Letterman would have his mom on every once in a while. And, you know, but to have like, you know, my Uncle Frank standing by the door every night and he's this kind of like dense man who is, you know, sweetheart of a man, but not too bright, but very charming and totally confused as to why he's there.
Yeah.
It just gave me something to work off of.
Yeah. So much of, you know, so much of like your job is a weird job, like being, you know, like late night. There's no sort of like late night talk show school or late night talk show host class. So a huge element of it is what makes you comfortable, what makes you comfortable in this space and in this hour that you have to do every night. And if it's having your uncle there, then I guess, you know.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, why not? Now, is it weird, do you think, sometimes for the people that aren't in your family who are working on the show? Is there like a dynamic going on where it ends up feeling like you're at someone else's house for Christmas and you quite, you know, you don't quite understand the dynamic, what's happening?
There was a little of that at the beginning. There was some inter-family auditioning going on.
Oh, wow.
Same with the security guards at the show.
Oh, boy.
Suddenly,
oh,
when Guillermo became popular, there was a lot of comedy happening from my car to the stage.
Shit.
Oh, but I think that it is a sign of respect for the people who are on the show and who are successful, and not just on the show, but behind the scenes. My, you know, my brother's a director and a writer, and he does Crank Anchors now. He's executive producer on that show. And I think that over time, those people in my family who thought I was basically handing out jobs have come to realize that the people I handed them to are very good at doing them. And that's why I gave them those jobs. I mean, obviously being related to them didn't hurt, but if they couldn't do the job, it would be really obvious.
Yeah, yeah. Have you ever had to fire a family member?
I have, yeah.
Oh, boy, I bet that's a joy.
Oh, boy, that's terrible. Yeah,
oh,
that's...
Oh, my God.
I mean, I don't... I hate firing people just to start with, partly because I've been fired so many times. I understand how horrible it is. But yeah, firing a relative is not great.
Wow.
It's bad.
Yeah, I'm going to try to avoid that. Thanks for the tip.
Yes. Avoid it at all costs.
Now, how do you envision your future? Like, what's the picture of yourself, you know, in I don't know how many years, but I mean, beyond what you've got now.
I don't really know. I know myself well enough to know that I change my mind a lot. I'm also impulsive sometimes. And if there's an idea I really like, I can jump all in on it without thinking about the realities of what it's going to require.
Yeah.
I know that, you know, I'm interested in producing shows. I like writing jokes. I like watching somebody's career develop. I enjoy that. I like, you know, finding funny people and having the ability to help them get seen. I love that. That's probably my favorite part of doing this. Mm-hmm. So I'll probably do that. You know, I think like after the show, I'll limit my activities as far as producing goes, because this has been such a grind, and it's, you know, at a certain point, it's enough is enough. You know,
it takes
up my whole day. And I don't love doing homework either, but I just feel like I have to. But I'd like to have an easier schedule. I'd like to have more options. You don't have any options when you have a show every night. You're doing that show the next day, and you need to feed it, and you can never feed it enough.
I've always called it laying tracks for a train that's coming, you know, like it's on its way. You better lay those tracks or there'll be a crash. Yeah. Do you think you'll be in LA? Do you see yourself staying in LA?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I like it here. I think there are things that are not so great about LA, but ultimately I think I could find things that are not so great about any place that I lived. And, my family lives here. My parents live here. My in-laws, you know, my kids go to school here.
Yeah.
It's probably where I'll stay.
Well, the final of these three questions is, what have you learned? I mean, you know, and that usually, whether that's the form of advice or, you know, like what you'd like to kind of make the moral of your story or the point of what you've been through or what you want to share.
Such a tough question. It's such a big question, right?
Yeah, I know.
And the answer is really...
I just got to ask it. I don't have to answer it.
There are really a lot of tiny little answers to that question, I think, more than anything. But what have I learned? I think that one thing I've really learned over my years is that, you know, you find yourself in situations where you want people to think you're funny or smart or just to like you, you know, for whatever the reason, whether they be social reasons or business reasons.
Nice. It's a better feeling than the opposite, you know?
Yeah. And I think that for the first part of my life, my way of doing that would be to be funny, you know, and have something sharp to say, you know, to really like try. And I think that ultimately, if you really want people to accept you as a fellow human being, you're better off being quiet and listening to them, because I think that people just want you to listen to them. And that's hard to, it's hard to control that impulse to just talk and talk and talk. I mean, even now as we're talking, I feel guilty that I haven't asked you more questions. I have to constantly remind myself that this is your show and you are the host of it, and that the arrangement is supposed to be that you ask me the questions.
Right.
Like if we were at dinner, I would never have done this much talking. I would have went home going like, whoa, what an asshole I am. I talked the whole fucking night. But that's as far as like, I don't know. I think it's kind of a big lesson really. And I think it's a lesson that, maybe I'll nudge people towards it, or maybe people just wind up just being completely silent at dinners from here on. Anyone that listens to this, but I do think that people want you to listen to them more than they want to hear you talk.
Yeah, and I mean that has wide implications through, you know, whether it's someone you just met, someone you're at dinner with, or someone you're married to, or someone that, you know, you fathered. Yeah. You know, it's a good advice, I think.
Yeah, it couldn't hurt. That's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, wouldn't the world be a little bit better, huh?
It would. It would. Yeah. We could use it being a little bit better.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jimby Kimble.
Well, that was fun.
Jimby Kimble, thank you so much. It's great to see you. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been a while. Yeah, well, now that we're coming out into the open, you know, we'll be able to resume our occasional socializing.
That's right. I could come over and trash your house.
Yeah.
You know, I know where you live. All right. Well, it's thank you so much for taking out some time for us.
My pleasure. That was fun.
It sure was. And thank you all out there for listening. We will get back at you next time with the three questions.
I've got a big, big love for you.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It is produced by Lane Gerbig, engineered by Marina Pais, and talent produced by Galitza Hayek. The associate producer is Jen Samples, supervising producer Aaron Blayert, and executive producers Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.